I trust that the statute of limitations on feast recaps and sermons has not expired yet. After all, in some years, in fact, including next year, we will still be at the feast on this day. And in 2016, I think, we were at the feast on this day. And plus, we're having our potluck and feast review next week, so I think I fall within the guidelines if I give you a little more feast information. The Passover, after all, and the spring holiday season will be here before we know it. It always seems like you think it's a long time, but it seems like before you know it, quickly, all these things arise. But a lot will happen between now and then. Of course, as was mentioned in the sermonette, a lot will happen between now and then. The holidays coming up this fall, I think the next one that we're going to have to contend with is Halloween. And then after that, of course, one that we participate in, and that's Thanksgiving. But then after that, there won't be any more till the Passover, basically, that we participate in. And those will be Christmas, New Year's, Valentine's, and then Easter, and I'm probably forgetting one or two. Oh, January 1st, the New Year's, and so forth. So, yes, there's a lot of things that will happen between now and then, and we need all the encouragement, we need all the ammo that we have to get through from now till then. Not that we don't get any the rest of the year, because we do. We have the Sabbath every week. So obviously, we can get refreshed during those times, but nonetheless, we do need all the strength and encouragement that we can muster, and the feast helps us to do that. I'll do a little physical review. I know many of you went to, probably some of you went to Colorado, I believe, and some of you went to West Virginia, and some of you went to Florida, and probably, I think some of you went to Georgia, and some to New York, and some to Kentucky, and different, just a lot of different places that people from here went. And we, my wife and I, and some other friends, and even some other people from here, went to Alaska. And I will have to say, Alaska, along with a lot of other places, but Alaska is one of the more spectacular places probably on Earth. But there are a lot of other places that are very spectacular as well. The first thing we did, we hopped on a plane and we went as far north in North America as you can go, with a plane or otherwise, and that was to Barrow, Alaska. And it was a unique experience. We really enjoyed it, had a great time for the 2 days we were there, saw how people lived up there, and they live different than we do. I will say that, because here, coming up in another month about from now, the sun will go down and it won't come back up till February. So along with that, it goes down to 50 below and even lower than that. And I'm not quite sure how people survive in that when you can't really see. I'm sure you'll have maybe a glow from the horizon or something like that. It's not like it's midnight in the middle of the winter in some places, although it probably rises and wanes somewhat too. There are times when you probably can't see, you can hardly see anything. But I don't know how you deal with that cold. And these folks have lived there for hundreds of years in this little isolated town of about 4,700 people with no roads going in or out. The roads that are there are all dirt roads, and they're all contained in the little town and a couple miles outside of town, and then they end at the Arctic Ocean or wherever you're going, out in the tundra somewhere. And that's what it is, tundra, with surrounded or on one side by the Arctic Ocean. When we left here in Cleveland, I believe the temperature was probably around 85 degrees or between 85 and 90 with high humidity. When we stepped off the plane up there, it was 32 degrees with a strong wind off the Arctic Ocean, and it was a shock to get out of the plane, walk across the dirt road to our hotel. But it was interesting. We learned a lot of things. We saw a lot of things, and next week we'll have some pictures probably to show for it. But then we came back to Anchorage where the feast was, but we had gone early, so we stayed there a few days and went to different places. We attended Atonement and the Sabbath up there in the Anchorage area, but in the meantime we went to Seward, which is south about, I think it's maybe 2 hours or a little over 2 hours south of Anchorage, and we went on the glacier cruise tour. And of course, that was very, very spectacular. We saw glacier calving. We saw orca whales. We saw seals. We saw sea otters. We saw eagles. We saw just an abundance of sea life, as well as some other life on the shore. And we saw, not that day, but another day, we saw dall sheep up on some rocky mountain. And I forgot to tell you that my wife, I didn't do this, but my wife and a couple of the other people that were with us stuck their hand in the Arctic Ocean just so they could say they dipped their hand in the Arctic Ocean. I guess they didn't have the nerve to stick their toes in it, so but they did that. But that was all very interesting. We went to an Iditarod dog sled camp, which is where they prepare and train for the Iditarod sled racing. This fellow Martin Boozer had won it 4 times, so he's pretty experienced at it. It's an 1,100 mile race in March through some of the roughest parts of Alaska, through the mountains, and it's a tough trail, and it takes tough people to finish it, but a lot of them do. We had a train ride one day that was a 6-hour ride down, way down, actually into the mountains. I was surprised at the elevation we got to. And we saw moose and bears on that particular ride coming back. So all that to say, it was a very adventurous trip, and we enjoyed it a great deal, a tremendous amount. But I wanted to bring that up to point out something else. As awesome and great as all of that was, the main purpose, or the real feast, is not the physical. The real feast is the spiritual. And that's what we enjoyed when we were there, as much as the physical, and probably more than the physical. And I'm talking about messages, fellowship, the camaraderie, and what happens. We were talking a little, excuse me, a little bit about that before services, that there's something that happens at the feast when you're there, and it seems like it builds to a crescendo. It may take a few days, and then all of a sudden you notice that things are getting a lot more calm, relaxed, spiritual. Maybe the kids were cranky getting there. You were dressing the kids. You were getting them all packed up, and you had a long trip and all those things. They were cranky. But after a few days of unwinding and being with God's people, something changes. And the spiritual aspect of the feast starts to take hold. And that's what I want to talk about, the spiritual feast that we had. Now, I'll talk about it from the perspective of where we were in Alaska. I'll review the messages a little bit, not in a chronological form, but more in a logical form, except for the first and last day's messages, because those tend to be a little more specific and a little more focused. But those messages, and you, where you were at the feast, I'm sure that you had the same thing as you started listening to the messages. And we had great messages, and I have heard almost nothing but very encouraging and very positive comments about the messages that people, that the feast goers had at the feast site location where they were. A lot of people have told me that these were some of the best messages they've heard in quite a while at the feast. And that was not the exception up there in Alaska either. It was the same way. They were some of the best messages that we've heard in a long time at the feast. And it wasn't, sometimes you go to the feast and, you know, for one reason or another, one particular message might really really stand out to you or hit you, but seemed like all of them did this time at the feast where we were, and a lot of people told me the same thing. When we started out the feast up there, the tone was set sort of in that first evening when we got there. And what that was comes from Deuteronomy 14, if you'd like to turn there. We'll go through step-by-step scriptures that were brought out in some of the messages. But in Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, and you might think of this as one of the two places, I think the other one's Leviticus, the 11th chapter, where the guidelines or outlines of clean and unclean meats are. And that's right. But once you get down a little further towards the latter part of the chapter, middle to the latter part, then another issue comes up. And in verse 22, it says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year." And we'll stop and pause there for a little bit. Just to bring or mention one thing, if you are hoping to go to the feast next year, now is the time to begin to prepare. Start preparing for that time so that when the time comes, you will have the money and you will have the necessary resources and funding to be able to go and enjoy it, knowing that you will not have to use your credit cards and end up with bills when you come home that you have to figure out how you're going to pay. So now is a good time to start to prepare for next year's feast, as it says here. "And you shall eat," verse 23, and this is the verse I'm really getting at, "you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithes of your grain and your new wine and your oil of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks. You shall eat before the Lord your God the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil of the firstborn of your herds and flocks." Of course, we don't really take herds and flocks to the feast. But there's provision for that, as it says further on. But here is the key to what I wanted to get at and the tone that was set. The ending of this verse, "that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." And that basically is one of the main focuses of the feast. The feast, obviously, is the culmination of the year in terms of the plan of God. It starts at the Passover, which was mentioned, and it continues to build through the year. It outlines the purpose and plan of God to his people. And we've been teaching that for many, many years, that that's what the holy days are for. But here is another important aspect or part of, and it really is part and parcel of the outline and plan of God, "that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." Now, this is not a way or in a manner of dreading God. It's in awe, reverence, and respect for God. Many people, myself included, have a certain fear of height. But I don't dread height. I just know that I have to allow or stay back from the edges, so to speak. I know not to put myself in harm's way. I know that I need to respect height. Now, this is not the same kind of respect that we have for God or reverence or awe. And there can be, if we don't do what we should do, there could be dread and fear in a traditional sense. But the basic thing is that we learn to respect and reverence and hold God in awe. When I climb up on a mountain, generally speaking, yeah, I'm way up, or if I go in an airplane, I don't have fear or dread of it. But if they don't check out the plane like they're supposed to and like they should, then that can be an issue. It can be a problem. And in those cases, yes, I think it's called what? Fear of heights is called acrophobia or something like that. It's one of those phobias, and I think acrophobia is the name for it. But that's the first thing, the tone that was set for the feast, to learn to fear the Lord your God always. And that's the title of my message, Fear God Always. And it's something that we do have to learn. We learn it from experience. We learn it from through study. We learn this through what we do in our interactions with God. When we're young, oftentimes we don't really think about those things. But as we get into our discipleship, if you want to call it that, as we get into our discipleship, we begin to learn to fear God and have a reverence and a respect and an awe of God. We have a hymn that's called How Great Thou Art in our hymnal, which is one of my favorites. Now, we can't really sing that one here so much because it's one of the hymns that is not, we don't have the rights to it, the copyright rights. We can't infringe on those, and so that's one of the ones that we don't really sing very often here, but sometimes in a special music setting or so on we do. But nonetheless, it talks about these exact things, the awesome God that we have and that we serve. And it is, when you think about God, and in Alaska and many places where you went, where you were at as well, the grandeur and the awesomeness of God stands out. The mountains, the valleys, the views, maybe if you're in Jekyll Island or somewhere, the awesomeness and vastness of the ocean as the waves come in and go out and so forth. Same thing maybe in Florida if you're on the Gulf Coast or wherever. And you see this white sandy beaches and the Gulf of Mexico, and you see all the vastness of it and the beauty of it. And that really stood out at this particular feast. Now, I mentioned that the real feast is spiritual. It does not mean that we are not supposed to enjoy the physical, because we are. In fact, if we read just a little further, and we won't really go into that much, it says if the way is too far in verse 24, Deuteronomy 14, then you can exchange that money for, or that your firstborn of your flocks and so forth, your herds, you can exchange that for money and carry it with you. And you shall spend that money for whatever, verse 26 says, for whatever your heart desires, for oxen and sheep or wine or similar drink, whatever your heart desires. So we are supposed to physically enjoy the feast as well. It's not that we're supposed to limit ourselves, but the real feast is spiritual. The ultimate feast, the fellowship and the messages and the togetherness of God's people. Human nature is war. And here's where we got into starting to learn the fear of God and the fear to fear God always. Human nature, and we had a sermon to this effect, that human nature is war. And our job, our commission is to overcome our human nature and to become and develop the godly nature, the nature and the mind of Jesus Christ, to be able to take, I think it's in 1 Corinthians, might be 12, where it says that we are to be able to bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Jesus Christ. And that's part of our job, to develop the mind and the character of Jesus Christ and to overcome that human nature that is war. James, the fourth chapter, the first three verses, James 4. It's right after Hebrews, if I can find it. James 4, and in verse 1, it says, where do wars, or where do battles and fights come from among you? And I love the book of James because it's practical and it tells you everyday things that we can do to make our life better. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in our members? Our emotions, our feelings, and so forth. We lust and do not have. We murder and covet and cannot obtain. We fight and battle or war, yet we do not have because we don't ask, it says, and we ask and do not receive because we ask amiss that we may spend it on our pleasures. We oftentimes, and that's what we're trying to overcome. That's what we're trying to put in the background. That's what we're trying to develop the nature of Jesus Christ, a godly nature to overcome that human nature that is natural for us, that is naturally in us, human nature, because human nature is war. It wants to war. It wants to be antagonistic, or it wants to be, as has often been described for many years, it's the way of get and not the way of give. It's the way of selfishness. It's the way of what I want. It's the way of what I think is good for me. The way of those things that would make me feel good or that would make me happy, I think. And oftentimes when we get it, we find out it's not really the case after all. But hey, because the human eye is not filled with seeing or the ear filled with hearing, it's never enough. There's always more that we want. And that's what human nature is. And that's where skirmishes and that's where fights, whether it's between my children, my wife and I, between me and my neighbors, my neighbor and I, or between my town and the next town over, or whether it's between my country and another country. That's where it comes from, human nature. It comes from us wanting what we want and not considering what is good for everybody or what everybody else wants or somebody else might want. That's what human nature is. That's what we're working on overcoming. That's where what we are working at becoming better at. And as the years go by, hopefully that's what happens. That takes another element, and that is denying ourselves. Denying ourselves. And in Luke, the 9th chapter, Luke 9, Luke 9, here in Luke, the 9th chapter, Jesus Christ had just done a notable, remarkable miracle. He had fed a whole bunch of people, and he had done a miracle as he did so often, and they had 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but they were able to feed, what was it, somewhere it says here, 5,000 men. They were able to feed with 5 loaves and 2 fish. And when you look at it physically, that's not possible, but Christ had done that. And then going past that, when he was alone with his disciple, now he said he wanted to see if his message was penetrating and whether it was getting through to those that he was talking to and speaking with. And he said to them, he said, who do people say that I am? Who do they think I am? Well, he said, some said John the Baptist. Of course, John the Baptist had been beheaded, and it would have taken a resurrection for John the Baptist, for it to be John the Baptist. Or he said, some say, this was, his disciples said, some say Elijah, which was another one of the prophets from the past. Or others say that one of the old prophets has arisen, maybe Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, or Elisha, or some of the other ones. There are even prophets in the Bible who are, their name's not given. They're just talked about. But he said to them, but who do you say that I am, Peter? And he said, the Christ of God. And he strictly warned them not to tell them. Then he gave them a little insight into what's coming in his life. Said the Son of Man, verse 22, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. This is what's going to happen. Then he said to them all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. That's to disregard your own interests, to put away those things that you are interested for another cause. He must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me, which is not easy to do. We are to focus on what's out there ahead of us, the future, not the present. It takes a lot of effort, denying yourself and restraining that human nature is not easy. We run into that all the time. There are all many times when we obviously would like to do, maybe we would have liked to stay in bed today instead of coming to services. Well, that would have we might have wanted to do that better or more strongly than to come here, but we got ourselves out of bed and got ready and we said our prayers and read our Bibles and did those things that we do on the Sabbath and probably every other day as well. We got in our car and we came here because it is the thing to do to meet with others of like mind on the Sabbath day. Do not forsake the assembly of yourselves together. And that's what we did. That is what we did. All of that takes a lot of effort, and we need to be consistent in doing it. God finishes what he starts, and basically we should as well. We need to keep that focus on the future. We need to keep that target in sight. We need to keep looking forward and keeping our eyes on the target and on the goal and not focus on ourselves or focus on the present, on the here and now. We need to be consistent and keep that in mind. Just over a page in my Bible anyway, in Luke 9:62. Luke 9, verse 62. Jesus actually concludes this particular chapter with this. And it starts actually in, what, verse 57. It said, it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. Well, that's pretty easy to say, and it's a lot harder to do, as this fellow found out. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Then he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And of course, Jesus said, if you want to follow me, you're going to have to do it now. You can't put it off. You can't push it down the road. You can't kick the can down the road and decide, well, I'll do it at a more convenient time, because it doesn't work like that. When God is calling you, then's when you have to take that and you have to grab that and follow him. Another said, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid farewell to the those who are at my house. Jesus said in verse 62, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Now, some of us in here, maybe one or two of us, have an idea of what it is to put your hand to the plow. I can tell you a little story that happened to me when I was trying to keep my hand to the plow. It wasn't exactly a plow. I was cultivating corn. It was on a Monday morning. And, of course, I had spent a little too much time carousing over the weekend. And cultivating corn is one of those things where it's sort of tedious, and after a while, it can lull you to sleep. And it did lull me to sleep. We were going with a team of horses, and I was cultivating corn down the field, and all of a sudden, I woke up and I was cultivating corn diagonally across the field, which is not a good thing if you're trying to cultivate corn. So the moral of the story and the lesson is, keep your eye on the target. Stay focused on where you want to go. Stay focused on your goal and what the goal is. Stay focused on what you're supposed to be doing and where that's supposed to take you, rather than right here, rather than right now, rather than inwardly to yourself. Being consistent is an important part of being a disciple of Jesus Christ. We mostly think of Proverbs 31 as the Proverbs 31 woman, and rightfully so. But it has a little bit more than just that. It actually has an interesting, starts out with an interesting point of view where a mother is talking to her son. A mother is telling her son what to do. And sometimes, this is the part that we want to get to, sometimes after we have begun to learn all these things and begun to practice all these things and started doing all of these different things, that we, as we learn them and as we gain more experience in where is it, Peter, I believe, it says that, you know, patience, to add to your so-and-so virtue and patience and the different things that we're going to build on as we go along. But here, once we've started doing that, there comes a time when we have to stand up. We don't have to just do what's right, but we have to at times stand up for what is right. We have to be ready and willing and able to stand up, to speak up, and to stand for what is right, beyond just trying to hide in the background and just doing what is right. In verse 8 of Proverbs 31, this is the mother talking to her son, said, "Open your mouth for the speechless." In other words, whether that is for another person who is not privileged like we are, or does not have the voice that we have, or whether it's just for circumstances and occasions, something is wrong, and we know it's wrong, and we need to be able to stand up for that and to speak to that and speak for that. It says, "Open your mouth for the speechless in the cause of all who are appointed to die," which says sons of passing away is what my margin says. So there are occasions and times when if you don't say anything, nobody will know and realize that what's going on is not right. Nobody will know that that shouldn't be done. They think, well, Freeman agreed with it, so he didn't say anything, so it must be okay. Whether it's the example you set for your children or whether it's the example you set for people outside of the church, we are obligated at times to stand up and to speak up for what is right, because the time will come when we may no longer be able to if we don't practice it now. We may no longer have the strength to do it. We may no longer have, little by little, we can lose our will and determination. If we, when it starts, something wrong starts, and we don't stand up to it, then it'll just get worse, and it'll get worse, and it'll get worse. So there are times and occasions that we need to stand firm, to stand up, and to speak up. We have to be harmless as doves, and what is it? We have to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a snake, or as a dove, I'm sorry. I'll get it right yet. If not, look it up. It's in the book. It's in the book. At any rate, the next step was submitting to and using authority. And we can't do that until we get to a certain point in our life, because unless we know what is right or what we should do, we can't really do that. In Romans, the 13th chapter, Romans 13. And we'll be reading in 1 to 3. Romans is, a lot of people feel it's one of, or maybe the finest work that Paul, or the finest letter that Paul wrote in its totality. It's a very, very strong book of Christian discipleship. But in verse 1 it says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities." We're required to submit to the governing authorities. "For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God." Now, obviously, if something is wrong, it's wrong, and then we can't do that. If they legislated that there could be no Sabbath keeping, we could not comply to that. That would be an authority that breaks a higher authority. And as Peter and a couple of the other apostles said, should we obey God or should we obey men? And he said, it's up to you guys to determine, but for us, we're going to obey God. And that's what we're going to have to do. Nonetheless, where we can and when we can, we are to admit or to submit to the authorities that are in place. "Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God." In other words, because there is no authority except from God. "And those who resist will bring judgment on themselves." Now, you can look at this a little bit from a different angle. There is no authority except from God, so if God has authorized it, then of course we obey it. In verse 3, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same." So we have to learn to submit to authority. And that's not just civil authority or government authority. There are authorities in a lot of different areas. Whether it be in your home, you'll have to submit. It says that husbands and wives are supposed to work together in a certain way, and we have to learn to submit to the authority that is appropriate. If the wife has authority in an area, then we should submit to that. If the husband has authority in a certain area, then we need to submit to that. As well as governmental, church, and so forth authority. It's not just one type of authority, but we have to learn to submit to authority before we can learn to use authority. We have to be able to submit to authority to know how to use authority properly. And here the golden rule comes into play. Do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. So if you're using authority, do it in a way and in a manner that you like to have, or that you would like to have authority administered to you. Then the next one, and some of these are very familiar scriptures, others not as familiar. This is a very familiar one. And that is, are we using the power of God? And the power of God is His Holy Spirit. Well, hopefully we are. The place we're going to go to is Galatians, the 5th chapter. Galatians 5, and in verse 17, it goes back to that human nature, and it says, "The flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and they're contrary to one another." And then it lists a whole list of works of the flesh that are evident, which are so and so and so on, a whole list of them through verse 21. But here are the spiritual principles, or the power that we want to develop with God's Spirit. Verse 22 says, "The fruit of the Spirit," what we're supposed to be learning, what we're supposed to be doing and learning and using, is love, joy, peace. And again, that peace is not always as easy as we'd like it to be. peace is great and easy to do as long as everything's going the way we want it to go. But when it goes the other way, against our wishes and our will, then it's a lot more difficult to have peace and a lot more difficult to administer peace and to use God's Spirit in a peaceful way. Long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and then verse 23, gentleness, which is meekness. And if we all had this next character attribute, I would dare say we could pretty much do all of the others a lot easier, and that is self-control. Self-control is maybe almost the toughest thing in the whole list. Self-control, and again, it's developing godly nature instead of selfish human nature. But against this such, there is no law. Those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. In other words, the disciples of Christ have started to do that. We have crucified it. We've denied ourselves. We have done all those things that we just read about. We have now started to develop godly character. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. If we live in the Spirit, let us walk in the Spirit. God has given us His Spirit to use it in a right and proper way, to develop these attributes and these characteristics and character traits that He listed there as fruits of the Spirit. We will, if we do those things, it said, there is no law against these. So we're going to be fulfilling the law, all the law. If we live in the Spirit, let us walk in the Spirit. We come now, after all of this, we come now to the fact that no one that has ever lived will be lost or forgotten. And of course, this was obviously, we know where this comes from. It's from the eighth day, that last day, and it is the time that the world has sort of forgotten. It's the time when nobody quite can account for. How are those babies who never have heard the name of Jesus Christ or person in some far away, remote, far-flung corner of the world who has never heard of Jesus Christ, how are they going to be able to have salvation? Nobody really, in most of the Protestant churches, has the answer or the solution for that. Well, God does. God has a solution and He has the answer, because no one will ever be lost or forgotten by God. In Ecclesiastes, and this is in Ecclesiastes in chapter 12. Ecclesiastes 12. Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes, has a lot of very interesting insights into how things work and the things that happen to mankind. But in verse 7 he says, at one time, and this whole last chapter is about, you know, the end, more about the end of life. It's talking about the millstone that quits grinding, and the eyes get dim, and the windows, it says, get dim. The doors are shut in the streets, and so on and so forth. When one rises up at the sound of a bird, everything scares you, and you get into that point in life where things are not as easy as when you were 20. When you're 90, it's not as easy as it was when you were 20. I'm in between there, so I guess I can know at least part of that. The music is brought low, and they're afraid of heights, as we talked about before, and the terrors of the way, and so on and so forth. And man goes to his, the King James says, man goes, this is in verse 5, man goes to his long home, or man goes to his eternal home. And it's the end of life. But in verse 7, he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was. We're going to go back to how we began. And we were made, if you read the creation story of Adam and Eve, God made them from the dust of the earth. It made Adam from the dust of the earth and then Eve from Adam's rib. But he made it from the basic elements of life, the dust of the earth, and then he blew the breath of life into them and so on. But he said, the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And I had never really, until I heard this presented this way, I'd never really thought of it in this term. God has the spirit. I knew that, but I didn't think about that God never forgets anything. God, that spirit goes back to God, that record of who we are, and God has it in his particular, wherever he keeps it or however he keeps it. And it will, one day, it will return to life in a human body, if that's the case, if it's not changed to spirit. It'll be in a human body. And John 5:28, for example, says, the hour is coming when everyone who is in the grave will hear his voice and come forward. That hour is coming. It hasn't happened yet, but it's in the future. No one will ever be lost. No one will ever be forgotten. God has a record of everyone that has ever lived, and they're not going to be pushed aside, and that's the end of them. They will be resurrected at some point. We, the church, God's church, are the hope for humanity. We are the hope for all peoples everywhere. Romans, the 8th chapter, points this out. Romans 8 mentions this. It says, in verse 18, it says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. I know that is hard. It's tough. All of you in here pretty much have experienced pain. You've experienced issues. You've experienced things that you would rather not have gone through. So have I. Everyone does. In this life, there is a lot of pain, there's agony, and there it's not always easy. Sometimes it is. Most of us have had probably large stretches of periods and times when we were going along quite well. But the time comes when that's not the case, and we have pain. We have issues. We have anxieties. We have stress. We have those things that cause us to be miserable. It causes big issues. But he said here, for I consider the sufferings of this present time, this is Paul again, are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Keep that in mind. That's one of those target things for the future that we need to keep in mind when things are tough, when things are hard. The earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Verse 21 is the one I was getting to. The creation itself will be delivered from this bondage of decay or corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. We are the hope for the future of all humanity. God has seen fit in his mercy, in his grace, and in his infinite wisdom to call you and I to be part of that future, be part of that hope that all humanity can have. And we're going to be involved in it in the future if we do our part and if we make sure that we are there. Which, between now and the Passover in the spring, it is some of the toughest times of the year. This is the time, a period of the year, when oftentimes we have to have the most strength. We have to have the most courage. It takes the strongest effort to make sure that we are still moving forward and that we're not going backwards. We have the opportunity to do that. The last scripture that we'll go to is Ecclesiastes 12, back to where we were. Ecclesiastes 12. We have these annual reminders of God's plan to learn to fear God always. We have these reminders that keep coming up. There are seven annual holy days. There are three periods during the year that we observe that God has given. And I think about this sometimes. God could just have written all this stuff in a book, small book, like one little book of the Bible, the Ten Commandments, and the holy days, and how His plan's supposed to work. He could have just done that, and it would have been, maybe an eighth of an inch thick or quarter of an inch thick. We could have read it, but He set it in a setting here so that we can see how it works in the interactions of people's life. And He made His plan hands-on so that we're going to be observing every year in the spring, in the summer, in the fall. We're going to be observing and we're going to be, as it were, doing a play. Almost a stage, as it were, a stage play, and so that we can learn to better understand what it is that God wants us to do, so that we can better understand His plan, so that it can mean more to us. If I just read something on the pages of a book and I'm not shown or explained or given some hands-on demonstration of how it works, it does not embed itself in my life and in my mind and in my heart like it does because we observe these things. But He has also given us one other thing, and that is He has given us today the weekly Sabbath, where we can learn just as much, or as we can, where we can learn as we go along. It's not like we have no other recourse except the seven annual holy days and the three seasons of the year. We have a weekly reminder. We can get together, we can fellowship, we can be here together. I always sort of think the feast and even the Sabbath day, it's the biggest concentration of God's Spirit that I run into. I look out here and there's a room full of people. I looked out at the feast, there's a bigger room full of people. And with God's Spirit. And if there are that many people getting together with God's Spirit, that's why the Feast of Tabernacles and the other feast days also, that's why they're so important and why they seem to be more Spirit-filled, more spiritual. They seem to be more energized than we are when we're just at home by ourselves, because there is more of God's Spirit around. Now, this last verse in Ecclesiastes 7 that we're going to read sort of brings us right back and closes the loop on where we started at the feast on the first day when we heard that we are to learn to fear God. It's the last two verses in Ecclesiastes, verse 13 and verse 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. And he goes, as I mentioned, he goes through life as it happens and some of the things that happen to people and so forth, from young to old. And he said, we are to fear God and keep His commandments. He said, this is man's all. This is the whole duty, and this is why man was created in the first place. to learn to fear God and keep His commandments so that we can take that next step into God's family. That's why we are to do this. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. It sort of brings it right back to the beginning, as I mentioned, that we are to learn God, or learn to fear God always, and this sort of concludes with that same theme or that same admonition and instruction. The Feast of Tabernacles has a synergy about it. And the synergy is that where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's as if you added all the days together, 1 and 2, that makes 3. And then 3 makes 6, plus 4 is 10, and so on, which should bring you to 36. But the answer you get when you add them all together is not 36. It'd be like it was 100. It's sort of what the feast is about. The sum of its parts are greater than the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. When you add it all together, you get more out of it than just 8 days. You get food for life. You get food to continue to go forward. And when you're at the feast, you sort of feel that. It begins to feel like that. It begins to feel like, hey, what's going on here? It's better and it's easier. It's more inspiring than it was before we were there. And it seems like the further on during the feast that it goes, the more it becomes like that. It's a combination of, and we had this in a, I forget if it was, I think it was the pastor's update or something here a couple weeks ago. It's the messages, the fellowship, and the activity is what makes the whole of the feast. But the spiritual aspect really probably should overshadow the physical part of it. It's great. The physical part of the feast is great. It's wonderful. But the real impact is the spiritual. And we show our fear of God, the awe, the respect, the reverence. We show that by how we live our lives. Learn to fear God always.